Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So, Rex, it's Josephine Ensign, and it's Wednesday, the 21st of February, 2024. We're here at Jack Straw Cultural Center, and I'm here with Rex Holbein. Is that how you pronounce
Correct.
It correctly?
Yep.
And Rex, I kind of know a little bit about what you do, but tell us yourself and for listeners what you do.
Yeah, first I want to say thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
I always enjoy getting to talk with you. So
thank you.
Yeah, that's a big question because I think of myself as an architect. I ran my own architectural practice for 27 years, got out of it because I met people that were living on the street. And, you know, in a nutshell, they, through sharing of themselves, they changed my life and got me out of architecture. It was you know, it was because suddenly I was seeing a side of homelessness that the negative stereotype had never shown me. And I was struck by the fact that if community saw the same beauty that I was seeing that was being shared with me, that, you know, that we would all rush in and want to end the struggling and suffering of people that were going through homelessness. And the only real means that I had to do that was that I'm an amateur photographer. Mm-hmm. And if I took the most beautiful photographs that I could take and share something beautiful about the lives of the people I was meeting, I figured that would be a beginning. And so I started a Facebook page called...
What year was that again?
That was in 2010, towards the end of 2010.
So right, kind of in the Great Recession.
Yes, absolutely. But, and also, I think at a time when homelessness hadn't quite crested mm-hmm. over yet into really all of our parks, all of the off ramps. It was really right at the beginning of that. And I probably would have done it for 4 months and gotten it out of my system if there hadn't been. On Facebook, which is where I started this, if there hadn't been an immediate community response, I mean, it kind of overwhelmed me. And 4 months later, I felt obligated, to be honest, to continue. And people began to show up, you know, at my office, dropping off gifts for people that were outside, saying, "Hey, I read about, you know, Mary that you told about that was living in the bushes along the canal. Here's a sleeping bag for her."
Mm-hmm. And so very specific for specific people that you'd highlighted.
Yep.
And then needed.
And then my office also, because I was starting to meet a lot of people, my office, and I was still doing architecture at the time, mm-hmm. Residential architecture. had a couple employees, and my office began to become a drop-in center, mm-hmm. right? People started just showing up to use the bathroom, to get warm, to get out of the rain. And, you know, so my front entry hall was just this meeting place. And I was also at that time taking all of these photos, and I had a printer, a really nice photo printer, and printing out these 4x6 photographs of folks that were homeless. Mm-hmm. And in my waiting room on a wall, on an entire wall that was about 12 feet long, 8 feet tall, I had a magnetic zinc loom board. And mm-hmm. so I was just putting magnets on these photos and lining them up. And very quickly, there were, you know, hundreds of photos. And people that were outside, it was becoming known that there were photos there of people in their community. And so I would get knocks on my door from somebody that I had met bringing two or three other people.
To get their photographs or just to see them?
Well, it began first, people would come in and they would say, hey, can I show so-and-so the photo? And then I would be in my, you know, drawing in my mm-hmm. at my desk, and I would hear them talking. Oh, there's Sam. I thought he had passed. I didn't know, you know, when did you see Sam last? And there would be all this conversation, right? And then invariably, as you said, the person that was new would turn to me and say, hey, can you take my photograph? I want to be on the wall. And so a community formed there as well. And
that was in Fremont, right, along the canal?
Yep. The house I was in was truly just across the canal and right up from the duck walk where mm-hmm. a lot of people congregated. You know, there's a lot of stories that came out of that time. Maybe
Dinkus.
Yeah, Dinkus for sure was one of the most colorful people that I met. He was a logger out in the peninsula that a runaway log hit him in the middle of his back and was flown to Harborview, died in the air, brought mm-hmm. back to life. And he just was this beautiful human being who suddenly was out of work. And homeless. Mm-hmm. He had many, many bits of wisdom for me in the beginning. You know, one of my favorites was, you know, if you aren't making one person smile a day, what are you doing?
Oh, wow.
You know, but just tons of things that he would share about his journey through homelessness that brought me into it.
And it was Dinkus McGink. Is that his, that was his name? Is that his real name?
No, it's not.
It's a great name.
Yeah. You know, we made T-shirts of Dinkus that had a big picture of his face on the front, and then the wording in the front was "Think like Dink," and you know, with a K turned backwards, like he always wrote
right.
Probably everything changed for me when I met Chiaka. Chiaka was a black man, about 6'2", that was sleeping in a cart in front of my office, and I had, you know, taking my bike into work in the morning early, and he was sleeping in the bottom of the cart. He had another cart that was full of art, and he came, I don't know how he showed up there, but he had been kicked out of a place earlier that night, and I had just tapped him on the shoulder and said, hey, you're welcome to come into my office for a cup of tea when you wake up. And he came in, introduced himself, you know, about an hour later, mm-hmm. and you know, while we were sitting there over tea, he took out about 20 papers, sheets of 8.5 by 11, and asked me, could I read a children's book story to you that I'm writing? And I honestly, I thought, oh, God, I don't have time
right.
for this. I've got so many deadlines, you know, like every day, right?
Yeah.
But he started in, and he wasn't so much reading it as he started performing it. He sang parts of it. He, at one point, got up and danced. And I started to tear up. And then he started to cry. And then I was fully crying. And when he finished, I was so overwhelmed. I just said, look, you've got all this art. I've got a shed outside. If you clean it, I've got all my architecture supplies in mm-hmm. there, you know, samples of everything that have been thrown in there for years. If you clean it, you can keep your art there mm-hmm. and not have to cart it around with you all day.
Get it wet and stuff like that.
Yeah, or stolen. And then after a few minutes of conversation, you know, then I said, I think what I really wanted to say, but I had been maybe afraid to say, and that was, and you can sleep there, right?
Yeah.
And
did he?
And he did. And he went right out to the shed and he spent all day cleaning it. And in the morning when I showed up, he had spent all night doing a painting for me.
Oh, wow.
And it was about it was on a craft paper. It was about 4 feet wide and about 7 feet tall. And it was of this giant lion goddess woman. And it was stunningly beautiful. And he painted it just to say thank you, right? And then he showed me his art and I realized, wow, you really, and I know this is an overused word, but he's really a genius, right? And he not only painted these beautiful things, he had explanations, long explanations of the meanings of them and such. And so I just said, why don't I start a Chiaka Facebook page for you, and we'll start selling your art. Because he was also very frustrated. He had been here in Seattle for 10 years, couldn't sell his art, felt that maybe there was some racism, maybe people were intimidated by him. And I said, let's just start a page. Let's see if we can get some of your work sold. Started taking photographs. And almost instantly, his work started selling. One woman right away bought a piece for $400 that lived in Bellevue. And then he started getting commissions. And it was really beautiful. That went on for about 5 months.
And so he was staying in the shed that whole time?
The whole time.
Yeah.
And one morning I come into my office and I read on the Chiaka Facebook page that a young woman, 18 years old, said, oh my God, I think I just found our father.
Oh no, really?
Yeah. And then below that, a comment, oh my God, it is our dad, from her sister, 17 years old. And then Chiaka's sisters all commenting, his mother all commenting, Chiaka, we love you. Please come home to Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow.
And so I'm reading all this just stunned. And he walks in with his morning paintings because he's prolific. He paints like, just produces paintings like crazy. And I say to him, Chuck, I got to read something to you. And when I do and I turn around, I look up at him, he's just streaming tears.
Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, I have to go home. And he tells me that he left his two daughters when they were 7 and 8, 10 years ago, because he was afraid that his bipolar and anger management issues would have a negative impact on him. And that his father had done the same thing when he was 7, had left. So he just had come to Seattle. So he said to me, he goes, come on, we're going to Fred Meyer. I'm going to use up all my food stamps and we're going to eat like kings tonight, right?
We're going to have a party.
We're going to have a party. And we did. And that was amazing. He spent the night at my house and at my wife's and my house. And we called one of his sisters. She bought a plane ticket.
Oh, nice.
And in the morning, at 4:30 in the morning, I drove him to SeaTac and said goodbye to this man that had, in just this 5 month span, really become a good friend, right? Like, I had spent a lot of time like following him around. And this was before I had started the Facing Homelessness Facebook page. This was like very early on. I had met Dinkus, but it was still just all kind of like, my wife every night would say to me at dinner, like, what are you doing? Like, what is this? Like, did you get any architecture done today? And I would say things like, no, I was like in a tent doing CPR on somebody that had OD'd and I was just getting taken away, but I hadn't created a direction yet. Like, I didn't really understand what was happening. Two worlds swirling in my head, very wealthy clients that I was working for and people that had nothing to their name. So I was coming home from SeaTac on the I-5, driving to the office, letting this all wash over me, and I just started bawling. And makes me almost want to start crying now, thinking about it again. But I realized I needed to start another Facebook page for people outside. And that's when it kind of coalesced, that there was so much beauty in the people that were struggling outside, and we were all missing it. And we were missing it because we were just not coming close enough. You know, we were at arm's length. We were seeing the issue of homelessness, not the person going through it. And that's a really big difference, right?
Yeah. And so there, I just want to pause because before we started this official interview, you were talking with me about like your own thinking of what gets in the way of people and like, you know, what you observed at the Women in Black. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we're all complicated humans, right? For sure. And everyone also is in a different part of their journey when you meet them, right? And specifically, I think we have to stop being judgmental. Like we see someone being callous towards homelessness, and it's very easy to say, you insensitive, you know, person you. Mm-hmm. But that's only one degree of who that person is. Maybe if you go one degree over, you find out that on weekends they save kittens, right? Or they spend every waking hour to try to help save the planet. And in all of the millions of variations of degrees that radiate out from each of us, we are at different points in our understanding of our journey in that direction. So I think we just need to spend time with people to understand on the issues that are important to us, where are they, mm-hmm. right? And give them grace and space to move forward. So on this issue of homelessness, I think we don't know enough about the issue in a very personal way. What we do know is the negative stereotype, mm-hmm. because it's fed to us constantly. And if we don't have personal experience, we are an empty vessel with regards to that issue. And being an empty vessel, we have nothing to refute the negative stereotype. That's why it's so important to just say hello, to begin your journey and meet people that are struggling so that you have something to respond back to the issue with, mm-hmm. You know. And also, like the negative stereotype is just that, is an overgeneralization. Each person is different and unique, right? And you can meet 10 people that are homeless and find something new every single time. And that is also part of why homelessness is so difficult to get our head around. It's profoundly unique and personal to each person going through it. Mm-hmm. And that's a segue into why community is so important in addressing homelessness, is that it's going to take all of us, the bandwidth of all of us, to sit with the issue, to be there for that individual person. I feel like you asked me a question and I got a long ways away from it.
No, that's good. Well, something you said earlier that just really resonated for me, if you can revisit that, is like what stops us from like responding at least just say hello or no, sorry, I can't right now.
Yeah.
In terms of the fear, but what's behind that fear? And what can we do about that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct that fear is at the base of it. And I think that fear is fed by the negative stereotype, right? Like we are told all the things that we are fearful of. Mm-hmm. The homeless embody those things, right? They're druggies, they're criminals. I mean, we all know the list in our head without writing it down. But I also think there are things within us that are part of our own makeup that inhibit us to reach out. And, I always say that ending homelessness has a lot more to do with changing ourselves than changing the homeless, mm-hmm. right? And that's an important distinction because we tend to put all of the blame on the homeless and forget that we too are, you know, in this journey. Homelessness as a crisis doesn't fairly accurately identify what the issue is. What we really have is a community crisis, right? The community crisis involves us. Like when we say homelessness crisis, we point to those people over there, mm-hmm. right? And that delivers us away from any part in it. But when we say a community crisis, we realize that we are part of it because we are all part of community. And specifically to a person, why don't we reach out, right? What is our journey in that? And I think in a big way, our inability to know where the line is, mm-hmm. for someone that is struggling with homelessness, you know, what will they say to us in that moment if
right.
we reach out to say, hey, man, how you doing? I hope you're okay, right? Like if I say that to somebody at the office, they'll say, oh, I'm all right. Or, you know, it was a tough weekend. You know, I had to prune and I got these blisters on my fingers, right? And but that conversation always stays in bounds. Mm-hmm. Like I have a ready snippet response. Oh, I'm really sorry, man. Yeah. That happened to me last week. Those are all things that I can handle with almost on autopilot. But if I ask that of somebody that is on the street, maybe a woman that's there in pain, and I ask her, hey, are you okay? She might look at me and say, no, I'm not. You know, yesterday I was raped. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, what do you do with that? That's a very difficult thing. And I think that's on us now to ask ourselves, why, as a human being, why am I struggling answering to another human being's real struggle? Mm-hmm. Like that really is a question to each of us. Where am I in that? Am I on autopilot, or am I really checking in with, you know, what my humanity is? And I think homelessness, in a way, it's always dangerous to romanticize or somehow put homelessness in a place where we can learn from it, right? But it is a gift to us in the sense that it asks us questions at every step. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm walking past someone that is homeless and suffering, why am I doing that? Like what is it? Like lean into that. Like why? A human being is suffering. Why have I decided to walk past? Or if I have leaned in, why am I leaning in? What part of me needs me to address the suffering mm-hmm. of another human being? And where did I stop? And then why did I stop there?
Or right? Where did they stop you, and what were your feelings about that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think these are just all questions for us to lean into personal growth and you know, help us journey to be the best version of ourselves, mm-hmm. right? Like if we're not doing that, what are we doing? As Dinkus would say, you know,
right.
If we're not making one person smile a day, what are we doing? If we are not trying to become a better person every day, then what are we doing, right? So,
and you'd also mentioned that we can't buy our way out of homelessness. Like we can't ask Gates Foundation or Amazon to just put up a lot of money and expect that overnight homelessness will be taken care of.
Yeah, I do think we should ask them to donate that money. But I think it's foolish to believe that money is all of the answer,
mm-hmm.
right? Like that answer, that money is necessary to provide the resources and open the doors that need to be opened to provide the drug rehab beds, to provide the doors to homes and housing, to provide the mental health care that mm-hmm. needs to happen. But those are not alone the answers. I've been to, you know, countless, buildings that are run by DESC and Lehigh and Plymouth and all the great, wonderful mm-hmm. organizations that are providing housing. But, and this is not a criticism on those nonprofits at all, but a lot of those apartments are filled by people who are lonely mm-hmm. and still struggling. And we know that relationship and community is the ultimate answer for, you know, the betterment of an individual. So, you know, that is what we all can do. We are, as humans, we are meant to live in community and relationship with each other. If we're not providing that for those that are struggling, right, then we're missing it. Right?
So tell me kind of a concrete example. I love that about, like, you know, the housing first, the permanent supportive housing that the organizations like DESC, Plymouth, and Lehigh do an amazing job of. What could neighbors, like, in that area, what are some concrete things that they could do to make it to be part of a community and to welcome people in?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question.
Okay.
It's a segue into something I want to share with you. But I'm going to first start by saying that one of the things that we used to, when I was at Facing Homelessness, which I'm wondering if I should go back to where I was in the story.
Yeah, definitely.
So remind me to come back to your question.
I will remind you. Yes.
So you know when I was coming back from the airport,
mm-hmm.
and realizing I need to start this page, this Facebook page called Facing Homelessness, sharing stories and photos, that page very quickly went to over 50,000 followers, and
mm-hmm.
I literally couldn't get anything done at work.
Your wife was,
and
good.
She was just becoming more concerned, still wanting me to follow my heart.
Mm-hmm.
It became apparent that I either needed to stop letting people into my office or start the nonprofit,
mm-hmm.
which I did. Closed my architecture practice, started Facing Homelessness with my wife saying, you know you're going to be begging for money now the rest of your life.
Mm.
And I said, I don't know. I don't think so, you know, kind of naively with my Pollyanna glasses on.
Right.
And I can say that we never did, right? Like we never had
to. Yeah.
It came. And that is, I think, what happens to every person if they're in the sweet spot of what they should be doing,
mm-hmm.
that the universe or God, however you want to phrase it, works with you to make
mm-hmm.
that happen, and money showed up. But for 10 years, I ran the Facebook page, and it progressively moved towards making asks for people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
And for those 10 years, every single ask was met
wow.
by this community.
Or exceeded, I'm sure.
I should rephrase it. Every ask was met and exceeded,
mm-hmm.
right? Like I made an ask for a woman that was about to lose housing and become homeless. She was 78 years old. Ann Knowles has since passed away. I made a post at 9 o'clock in the evening asking for 4 months of rent for her. It was like a $5,000 ask,
mm-hmm.
right? And in the morning when I woke up, because usually what I try to do is monitor, because the response had always been so fast that I had to leave my work quickly at intervals
mm-hmm.
and check the Facebook page to make sure, because I had to pull the PayPal link to stop the
right,
money because
right.
actually it was a problem to have more money come in because I had made the pledge that all the money would be used for that person, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would never go
mm-hmm.
to the nonprofit. It would never go to any other
mm-hmm.
Use. When I got up in the morning, $19,000 had come in, right?
Wow.
That was an example of like really every ask was just within a day. So the nonprofit gets born and I don't know how much I need to go into the fact that a lot of projects came from it. I can say that the intent always was based in the belief that the closer you come, the more you feel. The more you feel, the more you act.
Mm-hmm.
So all of Facing Homelessness's programs were a product of that one thought. So that was just say hello.
Mm-hmm.
Just come, you know, if you cross the street, right, when you're on the other side of the street, it's an intellectual question. Where do they get all that garbage? Why are they a druggie?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are they, you know, do they steal that stuff? Maybe the most important question is, am I safe? Right, but as you begin to cross the street and come closer, the intellectual questions turn to emotional ones.
Because you're starting to have a connection.
Yeah, like, are you okay? My name's Rex. What's yours? I didn't finish my lunch. Do you want some of it? Right, the whole vastly different set of questions begin to happen when you come closer.
Mm-hmm.
So just come closer. Right, that's one thing. We started the Feel Good Project, which was haircuts and massage.
Right.
Right. We started the Street Heart Project, which was doing portraits and then of people that brought the artist community in and doing portraits from the photographs I was taking and then having these big events where people would gather and auction off and money would go to those that are outside. The Block Project, which my daughter and I, Jen Lafreniere, who is an architect as well, put together that ultimately had me leaving Facing Homelessness to run Block Architects,
mm-hmm.
going back into architecture,
right.
which is what I, you know, only my daughter could bring me back into
yeah.
that. And you know, I love architecture. I'm a little architecture geek, but we got very excited about this idea, the very other end of the spectrum of just say hello,
mm-hmm.
which is one person coming closer to another that is homeless. The Block Project was one person that's homeless coming closer to a lot of people living in a neighborhood, right? We believed and still believe that one block home on a block throughout the city ends homelessness, right? We know that not every person living homeless is capable of living in a home in the backyard of in a neighborhood, but many are, like many. And when we say end homelessness, we believe that we will take enough of the burden off of the other social services that we can adequately then address those that need more intensive care.
Right. Well, going back to the housing first, people that are fairly functional but still need that connection and somebody checking in on them.
Yeah.
I can just see them thriving in the Block Project.
It's beautiful, and again, it benefits both people. The people in the neighborhood suddenly are getting to see, you know, Caesar or Bobby that are living proof that the negative stereotype isn't ironclad.
Right.
There's some chinks in it, like, oh, well, wait a minute. I hear the media saying this, but Bobby is this beautiful man, this beautiful Native American man that I've already learned so much and loves to talk with my children about Native ways, right? Like, so coming closer. But your question was, what can people in the community do to, you know, function as community around someone struggling? One of the things that is important to know is that, again, we're all different. So one of the things, again, at Facing Homelessness, when people would say, well, I want to volunteer, how do I do that? How do I go out in the world and actually reach out? My response is that ask yourself two questions. What are you good at and what are you passionate about? And if you employ the answers of those two questions to create a project for yourself, right, you'll be successful at reaching out. And the reason is if you're good at it, you'll make a difference. And if you're passionate about it, you'll stick with it. And those are both very important, that you don't just come in and then fly back out, that you actually get in and you do something meaningful for another person. It doesn't matter what it is. You could be a skateboard king or queen and teach someone that's outside that happens to have a skateboard, right? You could see that and go, wow, I wonder what they know on the skateboard.
Volunteer at youth care or
exactly.
One or the other.
A million things, but you bring what you have to offer. You can also go to a food bank line. You can do a more prescriptive approach, but I believe we're all creative human beings, every one of us, and we can take a moment to think about what we have to offer and creatively come with a solution. Why I started to smile deeply when you said, what can we do for someone that's struggling is that and we can get into this too, after I left Facing Homelessness, Tomas Bernatsky and I started a podcast called You Know Me Now. And we said, okay, we're both getting on the doorstep of retiring. Tomas is already retired. I'm 1 foot out of Block Architects.
And what did Tomas retire from?
He started he's had a lot of different career paths that he's employed, but the most of his career he was an illustrator and did very well. He's a very talented human being. And when he did retire and sold that business, he may have known of it, but he decided after meeting some folks that were homeless that he was going to do a documentary. Had never done that.
Right, and he did
Trickle Downtown.
Yeah.
And I would say to anybody listening, go listen to Trickle Downtown. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful feature-length documentary. But Tomas was hired by Block Architects to help us create a panelized system for building the block homes. We began by asking the construction community to help build the block homes, but we realized it was too heavy of a lift for contractors to give that much time. A number did, and it was really beautiful, but it had a shelf life, right? Like we would exhaust those companies.
The ones that were doing it, yeah.
So we realized that community, like a barn raising, needed to come together and build these. So we built these jigs. Tomas designed them beautifully. And now community can come in with no construction experience and basically learn how to put together a block home in a paneled form. And then those panels are then assembled on site in 4 days.
Right.
Foundation and all.
And roofing, yeah.
Everything.
One of my students helped roof one of them recently.
Yeah. It's tremendously beautiful. So
it won all sorts of architectural and green awards, right?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah. International Living Future Institute made it a legacy project.
Nice.
Jen and I got to do a TED Talk about it first birthed the idea.
Yeah.
And maybe one of my happiest, proudest moments was to step on a stage in front of 3,000 people with my daughter.
Nice.
That was really beautiful to look at her in that moment. But Tomas, after that was all done, he said to me, "Let's start a podcast." Mm-hmm. I said, "No, I'm not going to do that." And he, a month later, said, "Look, we got to start a podcast." "No." And then one day he said, "Hey, will you come to West Seattle? Let's walk in Lincoln Park." I said, "Okay." And when we were there, he showed me his recorder. He goes, "Here's the little Zoom recorder. This is all you'd have to do. Push this button to record people." And I go, "Here, let me try." And then I said, "Well, that is pretty easy." So, Tomas, thank you for talking me into doing this with you. And now we have 23 episodes that we have done.
Mm-hmm.
And something happened for me. I found one of the things that was very beautiful for me when I started the Facebook page was I found how unseen people were that are outside, this feeling of being invisible, and how important it was to be photographed, how beautiful mm-hmm. it was for them. And that really pulled me in. And I didn't think that the recorder would do the same thing. And I thought it would be off-putting, it would make people stiff. But what I found out is that with a recorder, people actually collect their thoughts in a more earnest, organized way. It moves from just idle conversation to, hey, I really want to share something mm-hmm. because someone is intently listening. And that's been profoundly beautiful. And along with the podcast, I've now again recontinued the photojournalism. So we have a very similar thing with photojournal stories on You Know Me Now, the webpage and the Facebook page, doing the same thing that I was doing when I was at Facing Homelessness.
Really beautiful photographs.
And we have just birthed a new project.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
this is why I smiled.
Okay.
It's called The Circle of Ten. And I would encourage everybody that hears this to go to our website, youknowmenow.com, and listen to what we're talking about for The Circle of Ten. And in a nutshell, it says it is aware that every person on the street wants to get off the street. Nobody chooses to be homeless. But it is also true that not everybody is ready mm-hmm. to get off the street. People are in different phases of their life to move forward. And some people just are still too far into that hole and aren't able to climb out or be helped to be even to be climbed out. But a lot are. And so what we want to say is, with the Circle of Ten, is that if you are homeless and if you not only want to get out of homelessness but are ready to, we want to bring 10 people around you who are committing to a lifelong friendship with you and that they will be there for you regardless, mm-hmm. regardless of your successes and regardless of your failures. We are now saying we're a chosen family. We're going to step along with you. If there are financial barriers to that person's progress, that those 10 people will not be responsible for the financial burden, but the larger community will,
mm-hmm.
right? We are really saying thank you to government, thank you to nonprofits, thank you to
churches,
all of it. But we're saying it's time for community to mm-hmm. step forward, and let's pick up the rest of the work that is falling through the cracks. And one by one, we're going to address, you know, the dysfunction that is going on in people's lives that are struggling by creating a very tight safety net.
So has it already started?
It has. Yeah. The first person is Caitlin.
Yeah.
You can listen to her podcast on You Know Me Now called The Learning Curve. You can go on the website and read about her journey. and also meet the 10 people that have now surrounded her and listen to her talk about why they are her chosen family. For the first time in her life, she feels supported. Mm-hmm. For the first time in her life.
How old is she?
She is 31. Oh. She's addicted to fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And she wants to get rid of her addiction. And this community, the larger community, is now raising $13,500 to send her to Mexico for Ibogaine treatment, which mm-hmm. is illegal in the United States, but legal in Mexico. It's a drug treatment that is proven to be very successful in not only detoxing, but completely cutting the urge for drug addiction.
And that's what she wants.
And that's what she wants. She actually found it and presented it to us.
And presented it as an option.
Yeah. And we looked into it, and it's compelling. I've talked to clinics in Canada. I've talked to the clinic in Mexico that mm-hmm. she is going to be going to. And there's some beautiful things that are happening in this program, such as one of the conditions is when a person is being helped, they agree to pay half of the funds that were raised for them. Mm. They agree to pay it back. And they don't pay it back to the donors. They pay it back to the next person in the circle.
Pay it forward.
Pay it forward. Exactly. So when this was told to Caitlin, she immediately started to cry. And her first words out of her mouth were, "Oh, I so want to help the next Caitlin."
Yeah.
Right? It gives her ownership in this process. It gives her immediate agency mm-hmm. in being part of the solution.
And not being charity case.
Exactly. And she immediately gets to help now, be a helper as well as a mm-hmm. receiver. For the donors, they know that this is not a one-and-done charity or act of compassion, that their gift will keep having health, half shelf lives for the next person and the next person and the next person. Quite frankly, you can, as we know, cut everything one more time in half, mm-hmm. right? So every time a person donates to the Circle of 10, they know that they'll not only be helping that person, but again, it'll just keep going, right? So when Caitlin believes, and she'll define this, she has reached success, like she has reached her goal. She feels like she is making it. She is housed. She is employed, right? She feels stable. And one of the things that are going to be presented to her when she gets back from treatment is she will have safe and sober housing, and she will have employment. Mm-hmm. She will graduate. And, there'll be this ceremony.
Yeah,
and then she will join the Circle of 10, which will become the Circle of 11. And now a new person will come in the middle. And so each time a circle...
So then that really pass it on to the next person, not just financially, but...
Yep.
So why magic number 10?
There is no magic number to the 10. There is, I think, magic to community, mm-hmm. right? Like 10 feels like it is a large enough group mm-hmm. where we can marshal enough shared support, shared camaraderie, shared belief mm-hmm. and energy that there are enough of us mm-hmm. to surround somebody and give them care and love and mentorship.
Right. But not too big.
Yeah. And I think it's more important to say not too small, right? Mm-hmm. Because I do believe that as this group, as it's visioned, is that this group will grow to the Circle of 100, mm-hmm. right? As it moves on through time, that group will become a family of 100 or more.
So then when Caitlin then comes back and becomes the 11th person once she's met her goals, then that next person then adds? So it's just going to keep growing?
We'll just join the middle.
Oh, wow.
And when she graduates, it'll become the Circle of 12. And while that circle is doing its thing, another circle will be formed, mm-hmm. another circle of 10, and will start its growth. And so the idea is if we move this forward, let's say 10, 20 years, right? Like I want to see a Seattle that has hundreds of circles of varying sizes, a circle of 40, circle of 100, circle of a new one just started, a circle of 10, mm-hmm. right? So back to your question. You know, I can envision eventually every one of these larger buildings that are housing people that are, you know, in zero harm type conditions, having a circle of 10 around that person.
Them. Yeah.
And helping them, you know, through whatever their journey of struggle is. And I want to be quick to say, too, that it's not just one way.
Benefits the people, yeah.
This is, you know, like right now we have, I'll tell you, all 10 are on the chat platform Signal. Mm-hmm. So we have that going. We're all like, oh, I went and had lunch with Caitlin today. This is what she said. Her mother just had a stroke. She's up in Everett right now. Mm-hmm. Everybody should know that. You know, so it's just like going back and forth. There's a conversation about, you know, options for her housing. You know, there's a lot of, as you I'm sure well know, there are so many gaps in the process of moving mm-hmm. into housing, into sustainable housing in a very wealthy city. You know, for example, when, like Caitlin right now is in Plymouth Housing in Bellevue. She just mm-hmm. moved in. It's a brand new building. But if she leaves, she runs the risk of, if she comes back from
the treatment,
she can't go back into that building. She can. They will accept her. But everybody in that building is using. Mm-hmm. She can't go back to that building. So she needs to like cut the umbilical cord and go into another
sober housing.
But if that fails, she's back on the street. So then the circle has to ask, well, what are the – and she can't go into sober housing right away because she has to test clean. Well, when she comes back, she'll still have drugs in her system.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're talking about, well, we have to find housing for her, maybe somebody's mother-in-law unit, maybe somebody's basement. Caitlin said in the chat herself, hey, get me a nice tent and I'll sleep in someone's backyard, mm-hmm. right? So this mm-hmm. circle is now brainstorming with her about how to move this forward. We also have a Google Drive where we have folders about employment, housing, mental health, all these various kind of folders of obstacles and opportunity mm-hmm. That we're all engaging in, right? So we see that happening in every one of the circles for the person that is needing to get mm-hmm. come forward. Oh, now I forgot. It took me long enough to get back to what I wanted to say. And that is, in that process, like there are people in the group that have no experience with having ever been homeless.
Mm-hmm.
There are 4 people that have had lived homeless experience
mm-hmm.
and that are now functioning. It's really beautiful to mm-hmm. have their voice sharing about the importance of what Caitlin is going through. So their knowledge is impacting the rest of the group. There are 5 people who are recovering addicts.
So they really know that.
They are covering kind of that base for us and educating the other 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have a psychologist therapist that is weighing in, that's part of the 10. So everybody's bringing information that's not only valuable for Caitlin, but also bringing all of us up, right,
mm-hmm.
in our knowledge and understanding of what the issues are around someone struggling through homelessness.
Well, and the other thing I was thinking about, the benefits, you know, the rippling effects of benefits of a project like a program like that is the connections and the human connections for the people that are in the outer circle. Because, I mean, you know, like the whole, especially, you know, the pandemic worsened it, but the whole kind of disconnections and loneliness that people have in kind of all walks of life.
Absolutely.
Can barely be beneficial.
Absolutely. You know, people that are living in $2.1 million homes, everyone says, you know, made me think of the song Simon Garfunkel, the Richard Corey song, you know, who had everything, right? And then he committed suicide in the song, right? Like it's really easy to look at people that are very wealthy and think, wow, they got it all together. Man, what a life. Doesn't mean that mm-hmm. they aren't lonely or they don't have their own barriers emotionally.
Or addictions, yeah.
Right? Like we're all as humans vulnerable to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to remember that's the beauty of community, and we need to reach out in that way. There's another circle of benefit. Caitlin has already relayed back to us, you know, as she's blabbing to her friends in her circle
mm-hmm.
in the building and,
mm-hmm.
and others, you know, they're all going, wow.
I want that.
I want that. Right? It's like, wow, you've got 10 people now that are like checking in on you, taking you to lunch, there for you. And, you know, and genuinely are caring about you.
And in it for the long haul.
You know, in our very first meeting, somebody asked in a circle. It was a meeting without Caitlin. Mm-hmm. We were really trying to kind of like, and you know, truthfully, we're building, you know, the plane on the mm-hmm. runway. Mm-hmm. Somebody asked, "What does success look like?" You know, and my response is, well, first of all, success is going to be defined by mm-hmm. the person in the middle. We're not going to be able to define that, but success from the circle of 10, all of us, right, has to be if on the very first day we meet with her, she feels loved, mm. right? That's all we're doing. Mm-hmm. We are letting her know that she's beautiful and she's amazing and that even if she fails 50 times in a row at whatever it is, we're still going to say, like I will say always to my two daughters, you are, God, that's going to make me cry just mm-hmm. saying that, you are amazing. Mm-hmm. Like you, wow.
Well, and showing up.
Yeah.
I mean, of actually embodying that love.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like doing whatever it takes as if you are my own daughter, right? Like making that like one of the important things in my life. So.
Well, you know, the other thing, I know we're.
Are we pushing her?
No, well, that's okay. We can go over a little bit as long as you can. But, you know, the other thing that is really striking me, I had thought about it probably a little bit more, you know, tangentially and theoretically, but now really hearing you talk through all of these things, including the new Circle of 10, is how, you know, because me as a nurse practitioner, you know, as a health professional, working with other people in helping agencies, capacity, social workers, et cetera, of how we are professionally, and I understand this, but we're professionally, we have this like, you know, embedded in us that it has to be private, or, you know, you have to keep, don't say that person's name or any identifying stuff outside of that, which I completely support in terms of like patient privacy, blah, 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 but also of how that can be so not beneficial for the providers as well as the people that are being helped.
You know, I'll share that when I first started doing this, right, I went to architecture school. Mm-hmm. I don't have any social training. The only thing on my business card that I can say like truthfully is that I'm a human. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all I have with regards to this work. And when I first started doing this, I actually had three, I won't name their names, but three different, at different times, nonprofits through conversation tell me, one actually called me straight out, cold called me, to tell me that I was violating this this gap that needed to be in place between the caregiver and the person receiving the care. Mm-hmm. That it was violating kind of this social services norm.
The boundary.
And I responded back by saying, well, then I'm not providing social services. I'm just a human being. Mm-hmm. And I'm collecting other human beings that want to get close, right? Because I'll tell you, this occurred to me afterwards. I didn't know it in the beginning. It was just dumb luck. But my office turned, my architecture office in Fremont, before the move to the U District into both the churches at different times, my office really became a drop-in center, like mm-hmm. like a bona fide drop-in center. I had food, I had coffee, I had a place to sit. There were a number of times I would call my wife when it was pouring rain or snow on the ground. I'd say, hey, you know what? There's about 12 people here and we're just going to spend the night. I got to spend the mm-hmm. night. I'd open all the windows because the place smelled. I have a high tolerance for smell. I'm pretty okay, but It was really bad, but it turned into a drop-in center. And I noticed something later that was different that was happening there, which was when people walk into places of service, of providing social care, mm-hmm. like I love the urban rest stop. It's one mm-hmm. of my favorite things that is going on in this city. It's such, so dignified. Or any of the other services that provide some kind of bricks and mortar place, right? It's beautiful, but there is a but, an asterisk, mm-hmm. that says every person that walks in there knows they're walking into a place that is providing care to a person that's broken. Mm-hmm. So when you walk in there, you have to walk in knowing, admitting, I am broken.
You have to walk broken.
I'm walking broken, mm-hmm. exactly. People walking into my architecture office were walking into a place of professional service that had nothing to do with their brokenness. Mm-hmm. There was a sign out front that said architectural office, mm-hmm. right? So they got to walk in standing up. They were visiting a friend that was an architect. And I think it's really important to remember that we can't put on our social service hat. We have to put on our human hat. You know, I'm sure you've read Craig Rannenbaum's book, mm-hmm.
yeah.
You know, Souls in the Hands of a Tender
it's
God.
It's beautiful.
It's really beautiful. And, you know, there's so many takeaways in that book, but one of them, the clearest one for me, was to walk side by side, mm-hmm. to not allow the natural hierarchy that gets put in place unless you work to break it down, which is I have and you don't, therefore mm-hmm. I'm above. You have to work really hard to bring yourself back down to an equal platform, right? And then walk up the steps together. And I think, you know, we all have to remember that. And it's a sneaky thing, right? Like we also all reach out with compassion and care for other human beings with a varied agenda list. Mm-hmm. It's very empowering to help somebody, ego filling.
Yeah.
And we have to be careful that we're not doing it for those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
We have to be minding ourselves to be selfless, to remember this is not for me. This mm-hmm. is for a person that's struggling. And I mean, the returns will come regardless, right? Like the human connection, the honesty of conversation, the beauty of emotion, those will all come regardless. But to receive them from a place where you're not doing it for ego.
Or pay.
Is a profound thing. It's life-changing, mm-hmm. right? So, yeah.
So tell me, and we'll probably need to wrap up, but tell me if you know what happened to, I'm forgetting his name, but the artist who you took to the airport.
Chiaka?
Yeah, what happened to him? Do you have any idea?
He went home and to Pittsburgh. It was beautiful and at the same time difficult for the family mm-hmm. and for mm-hmm. Chiaka. He didn't go home and suddenly magically have his mental health issues.
A Hallmark moment.
Yeah. Christmas cards coming every Christmas of a happy little family. There was a lot of struggle. Mm-hmm. There was initial, gratefulness around his return. And then there was a lot of hurt and anger mm-hmm. that his daughters felt. About 2 years later, you know, I stayed in close touch with him. About 2 years later, I decided he got housing.
Mm-hmm.
I decided to go visit him. So I hopped on a plane and showed up in Pittsburgh. I had a crazy thing. I don't know if we're running out of time here, but I had a crazy thing happen. I didn't quite know how to get from the airport to his apartment, right? So I was on the bus, and I sat down, and I was sitting next to a black woman on the bus heading into a neighborhood, and I said, hey, I've got this address, and I'm going to go and visit a friend that I met in Seattle. He's an artist, and his name is – I'm trying to find out where this place is. His name is Chiaka, and she knew him. And she pulls up her phone, and one of the cover photos on her phone was one of his pieces of art.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, so crazy. And so she points me exactly where his apartment is. She gets off the bus where I need to get off and shows me where his bus is and then gets back on and leaves. And I go to Chiaka's apartment and knock, and he answers. He takes me upstairs, and I spend 4 days with him. His place is a disaster. Flies flying around. The floor is covered. He went into an instant manic phase of trying to clean up, and I videoed him. He let me. But of trying to clean everything and just throwing things like it was like an just unbelievable to me. Eventually clearing a spot on the floor for me to sleep, and I had raised money about $2,000 for him to come for me to come there with. We went to Home Depot and filled up a giant cart of things he wanted to build, and he was building. He's just a genius. He's building this cart to bring care to people with. I mean, but it was all just, you know, it was mental health and just.
So he was in a manic, kind of a manic
phase. He was in a manic
phase,
and then, I mean, the whole thing was quite unbelievable and beautiful, but also sad.
Mm-hmm.
And
was he getting help at all there?
He was in and out of help. You know, it was, you know, his two of his sisters, actually, I had a video chat with two of his sisters a week and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
They have a nonprofit. They're trying to do work, and they want me to, you know, come and speak and do a bunch of stuff. Try to help, you know, with what their efforts are. They're trying to get developers to buy housing to create low income, you know, houses that are needing a lot of work that can be sold for next to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to get those bought before developers do, then to cash in on
Pittsburgh. Yeah.
So, you know, it's complicated. I think I would end by saying, you know, we all have to get involved, and it's going to be messy, and I think we have to be okay with that, and we have to just trust that when you get involved, even when it's messy, if you're really honest about your intentions of getting involved, that you can believe that the reward for you will be tenfold over what you give. And I know that sounds kind of glib or cliche or whatever, but I can tell you it's just so true, and your life will turn and twist in ways you never imagined. And I guess I would say I can't imagine anything more important. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we doing? What are we doing?
And what you're leaving for your daughters. I mean, the world that you want for them.
For all of us.
And what Jen has gotten involved with, too.
Yeah. I think that's what we all want. Like, you know, we're in a crazy place right now.
As a country, as a city,
as a
world.
As a world. We're in a crazy place.
Yeah,
I'm 65, and I have never felt that we've been in a crazier place.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it feels like, wow, something's really actually happening. And I think we can't sit and watch it happen. It only changes if we all get up and actually say, no, that's not what we want.
Mm-hmm.
We're not powerless in this. We actually can create the future we want to live in. And
that's all connected. I mean, climate collapse, climate refugees, political instability. Yeah.
Fear, society, all that.
Right.
And the opposite of it, love and companionship and beauty and that's all sitting there right there too.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
The butterflies.
Yeah.
Nice.
I want to say thank you for doing this and for being a voice the way you are.
Thank you for all your work. And I have to say, like, when I first heard about you and the taking photographs and everything from my service provider kind of a thing, I was like, what nefarious things is he up to?
Yeah.
And I just, you know, as I've gotten to know Facing Homelessness, Window of Kindness, Black Project, now this, you know, Circle of 10, it has completely changed my mind and made me really reflect on why do we do that distancing?
Yeah. I want to say one thing about it because I too have asked, I've been asked about the photographs quite a bit. And, you know, there's a lot of like edges to things that you can flip off to the bad side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, people will say there's poverty porn, right? Or you're taking advantage of them. You're somehow benefiting from their story. And I think, it all starts with intention, mm-hmm. right? Like, what are your intentions? Like, if you have an agenda that is other than the beauty and benefit of the person that you are engaging with.
And giving them agency in it.
Exactly. And that's right there with it, right? But to start with, if your agenda isn't that, well, then, yeah, you are susceptible to mm-hmm. all falling off that edge mm-hmm. all the time. But if you are there for them, that is your agenda. And as you just said, and you give them ownership and agency in that, right? Give them total control over that. Then there is no edge.
Mm-hmm.
Then you are in their field, and that field is wide and beautiful, right? You're just there for them.
Well, seeing them and documenting them, and that's, you know, a conversation I had with Jen Adams, you know, with vehicle residency stuff, where she says, because she was there, she was homeless, you know, in your neck of the woods when you first started that. And she said, you know, now, I mean, just that's like a lot of times that's the only photograph that exists now of the person that they loved yep. who has died. So
yeah,
that's huge.
So many people die on the street with never being known mm-hmm. or captured or remembered, or, you know, they just come, they have a little blip and they're gone mm-hmm. and that's it, right? Like I ask many times for people that are homeless, you know, do you have any photos of you when you were growing up? Because if you do, I'm happy to put them in the drive and save them for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of people, when the rain comes or their camp gets swept mm-hmm. or someone gets their stuff stolen, they lose those mementos, right? Like, and those are heartbreaking. Losing their only photo of their father, who they actually really loved, or, you know, their sister.
And
or,
if it was pre-digital, then they're just gone.
It's just gone, right? So, yeah. But it's not just that. It's just being someone in their life
yeah.
is what we can all do for another person that's struggling.
Right.
You know.
Well, thank you so much for your work and for taking time today. Really appreciate it.
I really enjoyed talking with you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rex. Okay. I want to join that circle of 10.
All right. Okay.
Rex.
There's a way to do that.
There's a way to do that.
Go on the website and down at the bottom of circle of 10, you can join.
You can join. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
All right. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.